talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. Welcome to a special edition of Talking Animals, by which I mean this week I'm altering the regular format, typically, of course, involving a long-form one-on-one interview. But today I've convened a panel discussion about canine companions for independence, featuring three CCI-affiliated humans and their canine companions, all joining me in studio this morning. They are Mary Taylor Jacobs, who wears various CCI hats, including serving on their board of directors and has been a puppy raiser for them since 1993. She's currently raising Frankie, who's here with us now in studio. Bill Gregg, who has spina bifida and remains independent with the assistance of his dog, Abner, who helps Bill with various tasks and is in studio now. And Bob Hoke, who occupies sort of the other end of the path from Mary in the sense that Bob finishes dogs that began in the CCI prison puppy raising program and has been accompanied today by his current charge, Dobby, in a conversation pegged to CCI's third annual Dog Fest walk and roll event this Saturday at Al Lopez Park in Tampa. We'll learn about various aspects of Canine Companions for Independence from various points of view when I speak with Mary, Bill, and Bob, and their dogs, with any luck, in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak with Nicole Green, the director of Animal Learn. She's a past guest on Talking Animals, and today will tell us a bit about the National Humane Education Conference, which will be held in Orlando next week. She sits on the board of the Association of Professional Humane Educators. Also later is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll offer a pair of tickets to the Fab Four at the Capitol Theater on March 15. Right now, let's get to our in-studio guests. Okay, well, we may or may not be streaming on Facebook Live. If so, it would be through my personal page, Duncan Strauss. So if you're near a computer and on Facebook or can get to Facebook, you can see our friends, human and canine, right here in the studio on Talking Animals via Duncan Strauss on Facebook. Otherwise, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Mary Taylor Jacobs, Bill Gregg, and Bob Hoke on Talking Animals. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning, Mary. Good morning, Bob. So I figure by way of introduction, we'll go around and speak with each of you for a minute or two. But even in those initial moments, and certainly as we get going again, I hope that everybody will feel welcome to jump in and add their two cents or elaborate on something the previous person has said. So I'm really looking for a group discussion to whatever extent we can have, rather than just some individual chats here. And we don't stand on ceremonies. You can probably already gather here and talk in animals, so it's very loose and informal. Laura, I'd like to start with you, since you have a considerable history with Canine Companions for Independence, having started raising puppies for the organization, I guess, 25 years ago, and you sit on the board. So how did you first hear of Canine Companions for Independence?
I first got involved with Canine Companions through a volunteer women's service organization, GFWC. They do a lot for our Dog Fest coming up this weekend. But I got involved with them. I did start raising 25 years ago, but it probably wasn't the brightest thing I ever did with a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 6-year-old. So I took a break. So this is my second one in a row since then. So I've been off the market for puppy raising for 20 years.
Oh, okay.
Do my first one.
It still sounds like bragging rights. That's a detail we almost should have left out. It's like, wow, 25 years. But then there was that 20-year break or whatever.
Yeah,
Bob,
you know.
Is your phone on the volume on or something? I think I might be hearing that, unfortunately. So if we could cut that out, that'd be great, because otherwise we're going to hear that competing with our conversations here. Thank you. So it was through that other organization, but still, why Canine Companions for Independence back then, and then obviously when you returned? What is it about them that appealed to you and then sort of reappealed to you?
We love dogs. My whole family loves dogs. We have several pet dogs of our own. We also have a dear, very dear family friend that probably in need of one day. And through watching them, it kind of makes me want to help raise these puppies so we can provide them for people like Bill, for people like my friend's daughter one day, and others around the country.
It'd be interesting to know, even though you took a break, as you know, but still there is that kind of arc of 25 years or so. Be curious to know what some of the biggest changes you've seen in Canine Companion for Independence over that quarter century.
Oh, a lot. Actually, yeah. The first puppy I got, we didn't have an office in Orlando, so our regional office didn't exist. It was a donated dog from a breeder in St. Petersburg that Canine Companions called me up and said, will you go get this dog and raise it? Okay. So we've gone from getting that kind of a dog to having our own breeding program in California. So that all of our dogs are bred in California, sent around the country to puppy raisers, and then on to our professional training campuses after they've left us.
And this almost inevitably comes up on the show when we do any kind of show that involves organizations that breed their dogs, because the first email or call that I would get, I might not get since I'm preemptively asking this question. There's so many people who say, gosh, with all the amazing rescue dogs and dogs that are looking for homes and shelters, is there not some way to obviously be very selective, but still use some of those for the program as opposed to breeding dogs expressly for the purpose of, in this case, of Canine Companions for Independence?
Good question. To be honest with you, my non-expert opinion, I know they breed them for specific purposes. We have Abner, who's a full black lab.
Mm-hmm.
He's, but I have mine, who's a golden lab cross. So my understanding is they're kind of looking for that lab quality, because labs love to have jobs and love to work, and that golden quality who love people.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to get for that perfect match of a dog to give out to our community and our clients.
Yeah.
And such, so that they're good representations of a service dog and Canine Companions.
Sure. And just Bob and Bill, I'd love to get your input. Just to what extent, with your own experiences and background, could you foresee some dogs that haven't come through the breeding program? Let's say it was a lab that was in a shelter, or through a rescue organization that dealt with labs, let's say. Bill, why don't you, do you any thoughts on whether a dog like that could in fact be trained in such a way to be Abner-like?
Well, I know, as Mary said with CCI, I know that CCI breeds their own dogs to be a part of the program. But, you know, so I'm sorry, Doug,
I just wondered if you thought, based on your own experience or just generally, if there could be an instance of some dogs that did come from rescues or shelters being trained in such a way that they could also be dogs for...
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that there could be dogs that could be trained to do the type of work that Abner and the puppies upcoming can do.
Mm-hmm.
It just takes the proper time and attention,
yeah,
and the proper patience to,
sure,
get to the point of where Abner is, where he's a fully fledged trained assistance dog who,
sure,
assists me to do the tasks that I need him to do,
such, right,
as picking things up off the floor, opening and closing doors,
right,
turning on and off light switches, things of that nature.
Yeah. Well, we'll circle back to hear more about Abner in a moment. But I was just curious, and Bob, do you have any thoughts on this? Just because I wouldn't say it's a raging debate, but it is a debate that seems to be bubbling under the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think reduced down, it's like, gosh, there's so many dogs that need homes. And obviously certain breeds or certain kinds wouldn't even really be contenders. But there are labs that need homes. And so I hear this a lot. I see this a lot. And I frankly wonder about it sometimes myself, if there isn't some way to make this work.
Well, there are a lot of organizations around who do that. I mean, there's one right here in town. I forget the name, but they work with kids who are troubled, and they bring the dogs in and they train them to be service dogs.
Right.
And so there's organizations out there doing that. We just feel that Canine Companions has sort of taking a scientific approach and trying to breed the perfect dog for this kind of work. So that's what attracted us to this organization.
Sure. I got you. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, I'm holding a panel discussion about Canine Companions for Independence with three CCI-affiliated folks, Mary Taylor Jacobs, Bill Gregg, and Bob Hoke, and their dogs, Frankie, Abner, and Dobby, respectively. If you'd like to ask any of them a question about Canine Companions for Independence or offer a comment, please call 813 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Also, this conversation, if you're near a computer and want to see these folks and their dogs, it's on Facebook Live via my personal page. That's Duncan Strauss page on Facebook. Bill, let me just go back to you a little bit more. So tell me a little bit more of your story, if you could, both generally and as it pertains to Canine Companions for Independence.
Well, before I got Abner, Abner is my first service animal.
Mm-hmm.
I had always had, my parents and I, we had always had pet dogs. But Abner was my very first service dog. How I got Abner, it's a very interesting thing. When we first moved here, I moved here with my mom and my dad and my sister in August of 2004.
Moved here from
I'm originally from upstate New York.
Oh, okay.
So we moved here and we had a family pet who we loved, and he was getting older, and he's developed some health issues, and finally, when he was 15, he had gotten to the point where he was getting ready to pass on. And
yeah.
So my mom and dad and I had started, we're talking about the future and what we were going to do. And actually, it was my sister who said to my mom and dad, "Hey, Bill is we had actually went to a Independence Expo over in Orlando."
Oh.
And that's how we found out about Canine Companions for Independence. And my sister had actually went with us. And she said to my mom and my dad, she said, "Hey, this sounds like something that really could benefit Bill and enhance his independence."
Yeah.
And so we talked to Melinda Sowers, who was the
program manager, I believe.
Yeah, program manager at the time. And so we talked to her, and she told us about the program and what the program consisted of. And so we took down the information, and we actually waited for a little while after that conversation because, you know, we still had a pet that was still alive at the time.
Oh, and it was the thought that there shouldn't be another animal in the house
Right. We wanted to wait at the time because we weren't exactly sure how our pet dog would
respond
to having another service animal in the home.
Sure.
And so we waited for a while.
I see.
And so we waited probably, I think, we started the process maybe, 3 months? Probably about three or so months after
That conversation. Okay.
And then we started filling out the paperwork and taking the steps towards getting Abner.
And doesn't it take even once that's in motion, doesn't it often take a while just because isn't there a great demand for these dogs?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, in my particular situation, I was on the waiting list for 2 years.
Wow, yeah, okay.
Two and a half years.
Yeah. And is that about average? Does anyone? Mary or Bob?
Last waiting list I saw was actually a little less than that now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we're working our way.
Oh, great, because I always had understood.
Not such long waits.
Yeah, there's the demand definitely outstripped the supply, and right. So that there was typically
in between we have service dogs, we have skilled companion dogs, hearing dogs, so the wait list is a little bit different.
Oh, I see, from dog to dog. I gotcha. So, Bill, once they said, "Hey, good news, we have Abner for you," was he called Abner when you got him, or did you name him Abner?
Well, when I got the letter saying that you are invited to team training, I didn't know at the time that Abner would end up being my dog. It's a very interesting process the way the whole thing works, because you go into team training, and how they do it is you work with three dogs.
Oh.
Yes, you work with... you work.
It's like the dating game, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, sense. Okay, I got you. Yeah.
You work with
that shows you how old I am, but sorry. I kind of, yikes, okay.
But yeah, you work with three dogs, and they do that to kind of gauge your, you know, how you work with each dog and what which dog will work the best for you.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh, okay, yeah.
You know, your skill level. And so... we went through that, my parents and I.
Mm-hmm.
They have a campus over in Orlando.
Yeah.
That's fully accessible. They have dorms on the campus. It's very nice. And so we went and we stayed there for 2 weeks. And we worked with three dogs. And so after working with the three dogs, it was decided that Abner Woods was the best match for me and my personal situation.
We call it the magnet magic of the match.
Okay. Yeah, well, there must be quite a, speaking of that, there must be quite a skill and just experience with the person or people that make that determination over after those 2 weeks of seeing, in this case, Bill with those three dogs. Like, there must be a whole formula, but it must be a lot by instinct and other things that those determinations are made.
Our trainers, when he gets his letter, he may be there with 10 that have their letter. We're getting our dogs, but we may have 18 dogs. So our trainers know kind of what Bill needs. So they've kind of, okay, I like these three with Bill, so we'll go. And so, you know, there's lots to choose from for our trainers to match with.
No, that seems like a very good approach. And did it work out from day one when you took Abner home? I mean, obviously you had worked with him along with the other two dogs for those 2 weeks, but when you got home, did it just work right away and feel comfortable? And
Oh, absolutely.
And how much did Abner, once you did get him home, how much did he change your day-to-day life?
Oh, he's been amazing. He's just been amazing, you know, Abner has enhanced my life in so many ways. It's funny that my parents and I, we laugh about it now, because everybody noticed me in... they notice me, and they know the first thing they would notice is the chair.
Mm-hmm.
When I would go out in public and I would interact with people, the chair would be the first thing they notice. Now, whenever we go out, it's always, there's the guy with the cool dog.
Okay. Well, that's neat in its own way.
Know.
Yeah. Which brings me to something we touched on a little bit about on before we went on air. But just for people listening, because I think some people know enough to ask, some people aren't quite sure, and some people sort of just jump into it. So when you see someone with a dog like Abner who has a vest on, what is the proper protocol for coming up and, you know, if it's a cute lab, you think, oh, I'd love to pet that lab. I mean, we all might have that instinct. But what is the proper protocol? Because that is a dog that's working, and there may be safety or other issues that go with touching without permission or not knowing what the dog's status is. So what do you recommend that people do that just come up on the street?
No, the proper protocol is, if you see a service animal with their handler, if you want to pet the animal, please come up and ask the handler before you pet the animal.
Right.
Because that animal is charged specifically with the task of doing a job for their handler. Whether that be, as I said, picking up something the handler drops, turning on and off a light switch, opening and closing the door. Or there's dogs that perform tasks in other realms, such as seizure alert dogs.
Sure.
If you come up and you start petting a service animal, and their handler starts going into a seizure or something like that, God forbid, you know, that animal will not be able to alert their handler that, hey, something really serious is coming. And, you know, so I can't stress enough for people to be very mindful of, you may see a cute dog and your first instinct may be, oh, I want to go and pet that dog. That dog is so cute. But that dog is
doing, it's on duty. It's working.
Exactly.
Yeah. I gotcha.
It has a very specific job that it needs to be on guard for a lack of a better term.
All right, so that I think answers some important question. I'm going to get back to Mary, but I want to talk to Bob because they're sort of, as I understand at least, sort of two ends of the spectrum before they might go and live with someone like Bill. So we're going to get to a caller in a moment, but again, we are having this conversation with various folks from Canine Companions for Independence. Just we're hearing Bill. We have Mary in the studio with us and Bob as well, and they're dogs, Frankie, Abner, and Dobby. This is kind of all as a prelude to the organization's Dogfest Walk and Roll event this Saturday at Al Lopez Park in Tampa. But Mary, why don't you just tell me, I'm going to come to Bob in one sec, but just tell me briefly what the puppy raising duties are and typically how long you're with a puppy that you are raising.
You get the puppy at 8 weeks old and typically keep it till it's 18, 20 months old, somewhere in there, just depending. My job basically is basic obedience and socialization. So take them out, let them to experience things, experience malls once they get older, experience Tampa Bay Lightning games once they get older, elevators, grocery stores, just expose them. We have a specific list of commands that we kind of teach. Mm-hmm. And then they lead into commands that the professional trainers start later.
And are you, over the course of that time, when you take them to a game or to the Publix or wherever it might be, are you later at some point recording something? Like if you see something, unfortunately, maybe where the dog didn't react in a way that's feeling like, oh, this may not be, I mean, I know there's a lot of different duties that a dog could do, but sometimes dogs do, as I understand, at least kind of wash out, for lack of a better term, of the
Absolutely.
Program. So are you sort of noting those things along the way?
We do a monthly puppy report for our puppy manager. So they keep all those while they're before training. So then our trainers get them. They typically don't read them. They try to learn the dog themselves and then go back and read what we said. It doesn't like elevators. It had a problem with this.
Yeah.
So they can kind of judge the dog independently, but then they go back and read our reports.
And in that situation, would they, once they kind of sussed it out on its own, when they saw, hey, it didn't like elevators or sort of did this at the game, would they try to do some more specialized kind of training to see about addressing that? Or would they just sort of figure like, okay, well, this dog's going to have a job, but certain jobs maybe it's not as well suited for?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. And they'll address the problem and see if they can correct it.
Right, that's what I figured.
On their own, on the professional trainers rather than the rookies like me.
Right, but once you've helped call attention to that, they can be mindful of that and maybe try to. So Bob, so we've got people like Mary that are raising the puppies, and then we got people, Dobby wants to get in on the conversation. And again, any and all dog, I know they're supposed to be very mindful and obedient and whatever, but if they want to bark, this is the place to do it. But anyway, Bob, so they come to you because you're a finisher from dogs that have been raised in the prison training program.
Right.
So what is your duty as a finisher relative to what Mary kind of briefly described as a raiser?
Okay, well, it's kind of basically the same thing, except that when I get the dog from the prison, they're about a year old. So the inmate, in my case, all of my dogs have come from Gadsden, which is a female prison up near in the Panhandle. These dogs, they know all their commands. They all know the first 30 that they're taught. So my job is to just get them out and do the socialization part, which obviously they can't do if they're behind bars with an inmate.
Yeah.
So I take him to malls and restaurants and that sort of thing, parks and whatnot. And interesting part of that concept is Mary was talking about things that the dogs get washed out for. I had a dog who demonstrated just out of nowhere the first time I tried to take him on an elevator, he totally didn't want to do it. I could not get him to go in that elevator.
Mm.
And I finally figured out through trial and error that if the floor on the outside of the elevator was the same as the floor inside the elevator, he had no issue going in.
Mm.
If there was a difference, he wouldn't budge.
Wow.
And I put that on the report we were talking about, the monthly report. And I guess they worked with Alan some, but that particular dog did wash out because he had a fear of elevators. So the things that show up in the in
yeah.
this, this part of the thing that can't always be fixed.
And that's interesting because it sounds like, if I hear it correctly, it wasn't necessarily a fear of elevators. If the elevator, like if you were walking in a hallway that led up to where the bank of elevators were and it had the same flooring as the elevator did, the dog would have gotten in and been fine. So it's not the elevator or the action of the elevator that spooked the dog. Right. It was just that the floor looked different from what he or she had just been walking on to get there.
Well, yeah, any kind of surface like that can be an issue for dogs that I've discovered. Grates and things in the road, I had a dog who had a total fear of grates. We'd never been out. The first time we were out on the street where they had grates, he went across it the first time, but then he thought about it for the next one and said, no, I don't want to do that again, you know. But they managed to work that one out, so that wasn't an issue for that particular dog.
And how long, you might have mentioned this, and I'm sorry if I missed it, Bob, but how long are you finishing them?
Well, like I say, we get the dogs when they're about a year old.
Right.
And depending on, it used to be that we had the dogs for 16 to 18 months, but lately we've been keeping the dogs a little longer, so it kind of has varied over the years. But I'll have Dobby until August, and in August he'll go back for his advanced training.
I see.
And so it has kind of varied over the years, but it's between, 6 months to eight to 10 months, yeah.
So one of our emailers, this is something I was going to get into, in one way or another, but let's get into it now just more directly first. They're just asking for a brief discussion of the difference between a service dog and an emotional support dog. I don't know if any or all of you would like to tackle that.
If I might jump in here.
Sure.
Obviously, a service dog is a dog that's been trained to do specific things like turn on lights and pick up keys, anything that might have gotten dropped, open doors. An emotional support dog is basically just a pet.
So there's not only a different amount of training. It sounds like what you're saying is, from your standpoint, an emotional support dog doesn't have any training to speak of.
Not necessarily, but in my view. But the exception to that is that CCI is going into a pilot program to produce a PTSD dog.
Right.
And they're
that's
doing
the first
that
thing
out
I was
in California.
Yeah.
And I guess you could consider that an emotional support dog. But our dogs are getting some training to be a PTSD, like taking up a position with the handler to protect their front and back and, give them. So the dog is kind of there to create a personal space for that individual.
Right.
And so they, even though it is just an emotional support dog, it is being trained to do something specifically to create a better environment for that person.
Sure. And Mary or Bill, do you have anything to add to sort of the distinction?
Just interesting on our PTSD. See, I know we're training them to go into the house.
Right.
Secure the perimeter, check it all the rooms, it's clear, and come back and tell their handler that it's good, you can come in now.
Yeah.
Just in case they have that fear of, so they are getting training with that PTSD program.
Yeah, and if
the
room had happened to have been, the lights had been off, the dog would go in and turn the lights on first, of course.
Sure.
And then go in and check the room out.
So it sounds like these PTSD dogs, at least within the realm of Canine Companions for Independence, have some of the same kind of training that any other Canine Companion for independence dog would have, and then beyond that get specialized training for the PTSD sort of track, I guess.
Right. It's just an interesting study they're doing.
Sure. All right, well, let's take one of our callers here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with our panel from Canine Companions for Independence.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please. Did you have a question or comment for one or more of our panelists?
Yes, I do. I'd really like to know the legal part of bringing a comfort dog into like a stadium or a restaurant. I mean, that's an issue nowadays because people want to bring their pets wherever they go.
Yeah, well, one offshoot of the question I just asked by way of our emailer is there's been quite a bit of news and controversy about people who bring all kinds of animals on flights. And a lot of, let's be honest, sort of gaming the system to bring basically their pet on. So, A, they can have it with them, and B, they don't have to pay a fee. So, caller, so I guess you're just asking for people to sort of address the notion of bringing these dogs to various places where the public's gathered?
Well, legally, we can't ask them whether or not the dog is a service dog or a comfort dog. We can't ask them that. The Disabilities Act makes it really hard for us to do that.
And right.
It inconveniences a lot of people. That's my question is there something legally that we can do? I work in a stadium, and it's a real issue.
Well, basically, the according to the ADA, you can ask them two questions. You can ask them if this is a service dog, and of course they can say yes, but then you can ask them, what has this dog specifically been trained to do for you? And if it's a true, if it's not a true service dog, they wouldn't have an answer for that. I run across that. I volunteer at a local hospital, and I run across that all the time.
Right.
You can ask him if it's a service dog, and then when you get to the part about what they've been trained to do, usually they just look at you, laugh at you, and walk away. And
so you can legally ask them without any ramifications.
Oh yeah,
What it's been trained to do,
right?
Because it's a real touchy subject. I mean, we've gone around and around this thing.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think if Bob's advice helps you, it sounds like it might, to stay within the parameters and yet still get some more information that might help you make a determination.
All right. I really appreciate it, guys. Thank you. I love what you're doing.
Thank you for your call. Yeah, because I think part of what's changed in some of the airlines, at least Delta and maybe others are following suit, is that in those situations, they now want to see specific paperwork. And I think that you need to take some steps in advance of your flight, which I don't think either of those things used to be measures in place before. So
yeah,
that hopefully should help us. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. In a departure from our customary format, I'm holding a panel discussion about canine companions for independence with three CCI-affiliated folks, Mary Taylor Jacobs, Bill Gregg, and Bob Hoke, and their dogs Frankie, Abner, and Dobby. It's been a little quiet on the dog front, but I'm gonna see if I can change that before we get out of here today. This is a prelude to the organization's Dog Fest Walk and Roll event this Saturday at Al Lopez Park in Tampa. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have any questions about dogs and some of what we're talking about in terms of their training and some of the way that we've learned from Bill that they help folks who are go live with them, you can call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. This conversation is streaming on Facebook Live via my personal page. That's Duncan Strauss on Facebook. So, Bill, if I'm not mistaken... There we go. Now we're hearing some talking animals. Okay. Things are picking up here.
I just used one of our commands that we trained the dog
okay.
to do, and that was speak. And he did a great job.
I think he gets a gold star from me, at least, for whatever that's worth. But, Bill, I think this is largely a rhetorical question, but if I'm not mistaken, one of the things that is notable about Canine Companions for Independence and some similar organizations is that the people for whom those dogs are placed do not pay for the dog or the training. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Yeah, which is...
That is, the dogs are completely free of charge.
Yeah.
You do not pay for the boarding or...
Training,
know,
all
training,
the stuff, yeah.
You do not pay for any of
Yeah,
that.
Which I've seen correct. Figures that sometimes that involves $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 overall in terms of what kind of money is put into a dog that's ready to do what Abner does.
I think... That basically entails, and Bob and Mary, you can add on to this and tell me if I'm correct, that I think entails the charges that are incurred by Canine Companions for training the dogs to become service animals. Am I correct?
Well, I think what you're getting at, the Canine Companions, estimates that over the lifetime, the working time of a dog, it costs $50,000.
Okay.
That includes the breeding that takes place out in California, the puppy raiser and the puppy raisers volunteer. We're volunteering our own funds to
sure.
maintain the dog during the time we have them. When the individuals get their dogs, there's continuous follow-up with them.
Yeah.
And
of course, there's veterinary bills, I would think,
right,
along the way.
And there are veterinary bills. And,
yeah.
And that all gets accumulated, and that's
sure.
where they came up with the $50,000.
I see. Yeah.
And that's why the Dog Fest, which is coming up here on Saturday, is an important part
of
it.
Well, I was just about to ask, like, how the operation is funded, because that's, if you think about all the dogs that, over X amount of years have been trained in place. That's a lot of dogs, a lot of resources, and a lot of money. So how is Canine Companions for Independence funded typically?
Donations, just like anything else.
Okay, right. Yeah.
We do have some national partners, like with GFWC, with Ukanuba, that does dog food and things like that. And here in our region, we have several of these dog fests around the Southeast region.
Yeah.
We also do a big gala in Orlando in October. That raises a lot of our funding for our things, but it's all donations and donors and fundraisers and kindness of people's hearts like Bob.
Sure.
Yeah, and another aspect of that, too, is the dogs who drum out, as you put it, a washout, as you put it, go into our adoption program, which also has a long waiting list of people who want to have dogs like this, who are highly trained, socialized, and there's a bit of a fee for that. So that helps,
defray the cost
of
yeah.
things.
Well, we're sort of in our final moments here, but let's talk a little bit more about Dog Fest Walk and Roll. So, Bob, I think you're probably our on-hand expert on that event. Do you want to just give us the quick lowdown on key details, what, where, when, et cetera?
Well, it's going to be at El Lopez Park on Himes Avenue, just south of the, just north of the stadium, of course. And
it's this Saturday.
This coming Saturday. It's registration starts at 10 o'clock and it'll go through till 2 o'clock.
And what are people registering for? What actually happens?
There's going to be a walk,
mm-hmm.
and it's free to register. You just it's just sort of a formality.
Yeah.
And there will be food trucks there, all kinds of activities for the kids, and through my former affiliation with the local PBS station, we've arranged to have Clifford the Big Red Dog there.
Wow.
So that'll be good for the kids.
Yeah.
And there'll be all kinds of activities for the dogs and the kids and the people alike. We'll have demonstrations, some dog demonstrations. There'll be some people like Bill here will be there to tell the folks who are in attendance their stories.
Oh, great.
And so there'll be all kinds of things like that to just get... One of my issues is that 9 times out of 10, when I go out with the dog and I introduce myself as being with Canine Companions, I ask him, "Have you ever heard of Canine Companions?" And 9 times out of 10, they haven't.
Mm.
And we've been around for 75 years, since 1975.
Yeah.
You would think that we would be more known, but our footprint in this area, particularly, is not very large.
Yeah. Well, so this is great outreach, event on Saturday.
Right.
Yeah. And will Clifford have a vest on when he's out there?
I don't think we have a vest that will fit Clifford, there'll be another big blow-up dog there that will have a vest.
Okay. There you go.
It's also open to bring your household pet,
yeah, people
your family
can bring
pet.
Right.
And
so
walk with everybody's, the CCI puppies that are around.
Nice.
Right.
So everybody's welcome. And it sounds fun. And it's from 10 to 2 or thereabouts Saturday, March 3rd at El Lopez Park. And there's a Facebook page devoted to that, right?
Oh,
if you
yes.
wanted to find
yes.
out more details. And to find out more about Canine Companions for Independence generally, there is a website, cci.org. So we have just about reached the end of time, folks. We've been speaking with Mary Taylor Jacobs, who's here with Frankie, who hasn't said a word, I don't think.
No.
Bill Gregg with Abner, who... I don't think also so far has said a word. And Bob Hoke with Dobby, who thankfully, for my purposes at least, has said a word or two, but only by command. So if anybody else wants to say anything, I mean, can't. There we see. There we go. This is... Now we're talking.
That's Dobby again.
That's a talking animal right there. So.
Speak.
Okay, good. Now, see, we got 2 out of 3.
Frankie hasn't learned that command yet.
Okay, well, we'll bring Frankie back for his first words on air. So, well, thank you guys very much for joining me today on Talking Animals. And in a few moments here, I'll be speaking with Nicole Green about the National Humane Education Conference, which is happening in Orlando next week. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece... kind of relevant to our Canine Companions for Independence conversation. This is Eddie Izzard with a piece called Guide Dogs in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Guide dogs, they are bright. They get chosen, especially chosen. You have the look in your eyes, the look of intelligence. You will become a special dog. The dog goes, food? You know what I'm saying, don't you? Come, I will make you a leader amongst dogs. Food now? With marrow, the yummy bit of humans? Come, I will make you a leader who will lead people with restricted eyesight. Food at dog shop? Dog food shop? I like dog food shop. And they're trained. These dogs are trained. They're there with come 175 degrees magnetic. Church with a spire. Meow. Meow. Ding-a-ling-a-ling, dog food shop. The trouble with guide dogs, they'll always take you to a dog food shop. You may not want to go there. But I met someone, I know someone in Melbourne. She had a guide dog that was a failed guide dog. Brilliant, this dog failed. It was obviously, You're no help.
Meow, 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 oh, meow, 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 meow.
Where's your owner? Gone upstairs?
That was Eddie Izzard with a piece called Guide Dogs, taken from one of his stand-up specials. All right, on to Nicole Green to fill us in on the National Humane Education Conference, slated for next week in Orlando. This is Nicole Green, joining us again on Talking Animals. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Great. Good to be here.
Yeah. So when you were on previously, we discussed the importance and the inroads, really, of humane education at sort of all levels. Can you just briefly review or summarize that conversation before we get into next week's proceedings?
Well, so basically what humane education is and what the organization that I now serving on the board of is the Association of Professional Humane Educators. And our main goal is basically to try and make a difference for animals, people, and the environment. And by doing that, we invite professionals to become, to network together, to really kind of plant those seeds of compassion in our communities. And we do that through resources that we distribute, different programs that people are running. And our main goal is to get more of humane educators on board and to really facilitate kindness towards everyone, really, at this point, because we live in such a violent society. It's about time that we kind of, encourage more humane education programs and had more mandatory programs in schools and communities.
I guess what we're trying to do is move a far cry from the days of biology class and dissecting the cliched frog.
Well, it's all a part of that. I mean, I wear different hats. I work as the director of education for Animal Learn, where we try to educate people about the horrors and the issue of animal dissection and using alternatives. But what I can do as a part of, working for representing this organization, I can also encourage other teachers who are working in humane education to enlighten their communities and the kids about alternatives. So it's sort of like just kind of encouraging more people to understand that the many different issues that plague our society.
And I think part of what we discussed when you were on before is that the aim here is to really make these kind of changes, implement these kind of changes at all levels of education. So it's not just the biology class in elementary school that we just addressed, but all the way up to medical school.
Oh, exactly. I mean, anyone can benefit from humane education. It doesn't have to be just elementary school kids or high school kids. Everyone can benefit, and it doesn't matter how old you are. You can benefit from learning how to be kind and compassionate to animals. I think it's needed. It's necessary in the world today.
And the thing that I think we touched on then and probably more so now is that technology and all the advances have really kind of afforded greater and greater opportunities for still the kind of learning that needs to happen at med school as you're training doctors, but to still be effective in that way, even with virtual reality and video things and other things that are, again, not bodies, animal bodies or other bodies
exactly
as they once were.
Yeah, definitely.
So this conference takes place starting next week in Orlando, and it's, three days. So is it all just sort of people like yourself sharing ideas and trying to even broaden out the array of people that are aware of some of the advances that have been made and just new ways to present curriculum of these kinds?
Yeah, definitely. So it's really a variety of different people. People from animal shelters who do humane education programs there, animal care and control agencies, people from zoos and museums, schools, colleges, universities, teachers in the community, animal welfarists, animal rights activists. It could really be anyone who's out there and is engaging with animals or the public in some capacity and trying to plant those seeds of compassion and kindness. So we invite all of those professionals to come, and it's really an opportunity to network with people and to kind of reinvigorate yourself, because a lot of times humane educators are that lone person or people in the community, and it really kind of is inspiring to come to a conference where you have people like yourself doing this type of work, and to kind of reinvigorate and learn different methods, learn how different people are running different programs, and to really get those things going and to continue the work that you do.
That's great.
Why I really would love to see more and more people come to our conference.
Sure. Well, we're just about out of time here at the moment, Nicole, but is there either a website or Facebook page or both that you can mention that people who might be interested, since it sounds like it's wide open for people to attend, and obviously you're reaching out to a broad section of people who do work in and around animals, animal welfare, and education, et cetera. So where could someone find out more online?
So if you want to, the name of our conference is Bring the Magic of Humane Education into Your World, you can go to apheconference.com and learn everything that you need to know and how to make change in your community for animals, people, and the environment.
Great. All right, Nicole. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and filling us in on Talking Animals, and good luck with what sounds like a fabulous conference next week.
Thank you so much, Duncan.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF is Rob Lori and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Meanwhile, on this show, is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see the Fab Four at the Capitol Theater on March 15th. This is a giveaway. Please only participate if you haven't won something in the last 90 days. Tickets to that Fab Four, to the first person to call is 813-239-9663. It's Talking Animals. Name That Animal Tune. Any guesses? We'll take them off the air because we have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lori is up next with Radioactivity. Hope you join me next week when my guest will be Challenger, a bald eagle. Well, there may be a human involved as well, but if that piques your curiosity, I hope you'll join us next week. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Speak again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.